The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
We're on time. That's unusual. Maybe because I said 20 minutes instead of 15. Which is exactly. I can't believe it. So, a little bit louder? Maybe a little louder? Let's see, how is that better? Okay. So, one of the philosophical controversies in Buddhist philosophy, whatever, especially here in the West, is the nature of the true nature of a human being. And are we inherently good? Do we have Buddha nature, for example, the Buddhist term, Buddha nature? And that's like our natural, you know, in our natural state, the true essence of who we are is just all good. And just get back to our essence. Or there's no real essence. There's no true nature. But rather, we have a capacity, a potential for cultivating and developing ourselves, ourselves into someone who has a lot of goodness. We have capacity to cultivate and develop ourselves into something that, it becomes a Buddha even. So which of those is it? It probably is not so necessary to decide. Just as important, it's important to practice, but it is kind of inspiring. Some people are inspired by the idea that we have this true nature. Some people are inspired by the idea that we can develop ourselves and grow. Many years ago, there was maybe 20 years ago now, there was a great article, interview, with a young man. He was I think he was 14 or 15, who was the son of a man from Montana, a Caucasian man from Montana, and a Tibetan mother from India. And this boy who was growing up in Montana had been recognized as a tulku, as a reincarnated Buddhist Lama. So he was gotten some education in India about being a Buddhist in Buddhism and was going to ordinary high school or whatever. But he was recognized as being a teacher. And so it was this very interesting. He was a little bit punk-like, little bit, you know, had a little attitude like a 14, 15-year-old, and one of the things he said was, you know, the Chinese are supposed to be my enemy, but when I'm in high school, and, you know, there's only three of us foreigners in the high school, and there's two Chinese and me, and like, we have to band together, you know, otherwise it's hard for us. And he said, all these people come to me for relationship advice. But, you know, I'm 14. What am I supposed to... I'm supposed to know. You know, I don't know anything about these things. So my father gave me the business card of a local therapist, so I just hand that out when they ask me relationship advice. But the reason I'm talking about now is that he was kind of critical or impatient with what had become a kind of standard dogma in American Buddhism, as American Buddhist teachings, philosophy had developed. And one of the standards kind of like teachings in the modern West is close to this idea that we're innately good and we don't have to do anything. It's not about doing anything or accomplishing anything. It's just relaxing and trusting that we're good, just relaxing, just being, because in the being we're just all good. And for many Westerners, this is a very important and very useful teaching. But here, the next generation, he was like so fed up with that teaching, maybe because he grew up with it or something. And he was more interested and delighted in the idea, but you have to do things and you have to kind of practice and develop yourself, and that's what's fun, that's what's interesting. And so it goes, right? One generation after another, the teachings change, and you know what was radical for one generation becomes the orthodoxy for the next. So then it changes back and forth. So my time is just about up in terms of the being radical. I'm ordinary bourgeois suburban teachings here. I look forward to the next generation. The anyway, this is a long way of saying that go back to the Buddha. He doesn't really come down either side of this strongly in this natural state. Are we naturally good, or we develop ourselves to be good, or something? But as I said earlier, he seems just to imply or assume that we're compassionate. They're just there. Whether it's natural or not, he doesn't say, but it's just assumed that it's there. But also, what's assumed is that the path of practice, the path of spiritual development, is not only something that we have to do, but it's something also that unfolds on its own. It's kind of like we enter into a river and the river takes us downstream. And so we enter into the river of the Dharma and it'll carry us. And so one of the ways this is described is that it says that for someone who is virtuous, if they're virtuous, if they live ethically, what will follow as you float down the river is what follows is freedom from remorse. You don't have any reason to feel bad about yourself. If you feel freedom from remorse, what follows is you'll be glad. If you're glad, what follows is you'll have joy. If you're joyful, what follows is you'll become tranquil. You'll become relaxed. If you become relaxed, what follows is you'll become happy. If you're happy, what follows is you'll get concentrated. If you get concentrated, what follows is you'll see things as they are. As you see things as they are, there's a continual kind of unfolding. It goes on until eventually you get liberated. So rather than liberation, the path of liberation being an uphill climb to climb up to the top of the mountain, it's more like entering into the river and floating along downhill. So what does it take for us to, you know, enter that river and allow ourselves to float? How is it that our ethical virtue can be a source of floating down to maturity rather than going uphill? And one of them is to appreciate and delight in our ethical goodness, to take time to appreciate it, to value it, to see it as important, to cherish it. And that takes some self-reflection, it takes some self-awareness, it takes some effort to do that. But without that kind of being open to appreciate it, we probably won't float in the river that way. And not a lot of people have taken time to appreciate this themselves. That makes sense enough? Okay. So now we're going to change gears. The foundation for ethical speaking in ways that supports the path, supports, expresses compassion, the foundation for speaking, I would like to suggest, is good listening, skillful listening, being able to listen well. And that without learning how to be a good listener, it's hard to be a good speaker. It's hard to speak in a mindful way, in a conscientious way, in a good way. And that listening is very close to mindfulness because it involves being receptive to what is and seeing, listening, being attentive, perceiving clearly what's going on before we interfere or get involved with our life and act. Listening is a very interesting thing to listen because it does involve giving up a certain degree of control. When you're willing to listen, you're not in control of what's being said. And so you have to kind of go along with it, within reason, right? And one of the reasons why I think people like to interrupt is they don't want to lose control. They want to be in control, and they want to kind of establish what's what, what's what. But there has to be a willingness to kind of give up a certain degree of control of the situation so we can listen and take it in most fully. When we listen not only to the words being spoken, but we can listen to the motivations behind why someone speaks. What's going on in the person? We listen to the tone of their voice, the emotional quality of what's happening. We listen even to their background, their intention, what they're hoping for. You kind of listen more deeply. Listening is very important. And so I thought we would do an exercise on listening. You've been listening to me, so sorry about that. But now you'll listen to each other. And this is how I would like to suggest we do this. Is you have a discussion, you share with others, something simple about what you have learned over your lifetime, what lessons you've learned, what you've learned about being a listener. What have you learned about listening? When you share what you've learned, make an effort not to tell a long story, the whole story of how you came to learn it. You might want to say just very briefly something about the story, but not more than a sentence or two. Just something very, try to be brief. And really kind of share, share what you've learned, why it's important, and something brief about how you learned it. So just share something about this, what you've learned. The other people in the group, your job is to listen to that. And the person speaking is not really doing the exercise. It's the rest of you, who you're giving the chance for the other people to do the exercise, which is to really listen to the person as they speak. Make sense? Okay. And I would like to do this in groups of four. And you'll talk in the group of four in a clockwise manner. And once the person who shared has stopped speaking, now the advanced aspect of this exercise happens. And that is, the person who's next turn to speak, before that person speaks, pauses, relaxes, whatever way you can, just a little bit. Just pause, relax, and then restate what you just heard from your partner to your right. Once you've restated it, what you've heard, pause, relax, and then offer what you've learned about listening over your lifetime. When you've finished offering that, the person next to you, to your left, will pause, relax, restate what they heard from you, then pause and relax, and then offer what they have to say. Is this making some sense? And one of the things this kind of exercise does is hopefully will interrupt the very strong tendency we have to plan what we're going to say. And if you know you're the next one to speak, it's not uncommon for people to not really listen to the person just before, because they're getting ready for what they're going to say. But here, you're learning to listen. And you're learning to try, hopefully, learning something about trusting that what you're going to say will emerge. Don't plan ahead. Don't think about what you're going to say. See what just comes. There's a good people. You can pause. Good people, they'll wait for you. Something comes. And the idea is to go around the group of four of you a few rounds, around and around, because what often happens is that the first time we say the things we have said other times, things we know, the obvious things. But as we go around, you hear what the other people say, and it reminds you of something, or tells you something, or sparks something inside of you that you wouldn't have thought of before. And so it becomes kind of a mutual process where you kind of influence each other, and it becomes an exploration of this topic of listening. What are some of the important lessons that a human being can live by in relationship to being a good listener, to listening? Is this making sense? Enough? Are you guys motivated for this? Is this like, okay, yeah? Okay. If you're new to all this, this kind of way, and you're ready to bolt, a lot of people who here have been coming for a long time have had that feeling of wanting, the first time they come, I don't know what I'm going to do this. But I've come to appreciate these processes a lot. So hopefully it makes it a little easier to stay. And so I'll repeat that in a moment, but why don't you first form groups of four, and then just be quiet, and then I'll kind of review it once more so you all get it. Okay, so groups of four. So I would love to hear what that was like. You know what it was like. You were in it, but I was left out. So what was that like to do that? Anybody want to share something about it? Because I also imagine each group was different, so it might be nice to hear some of the varieties.
I noticed, and my partners agreed when it came up.
That
even though we weren't in charge of speaking next and summarizing or repeating what we were just hearing, the very idea had all of us listening hard like that, no matter who was speaking. So I don't know what to make of that other than maybe it's planting that idea in your head really helps, even if you're not going to actually do. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was quite interesting.
Great, thank you.
Yes, I really enjoyed that also. And I think it was wonderful to start talking about speech by talking about listening. And as we talked about what we've learned, or maybe it would be better to say what we're struggling with still in listening, it was really great to share that and to bring it to our attention. Very good.
Great, thank you. Maybe it's also good to, say each other's names, your name when you speak, so we get to know each other better.
Marilyn.
Hi, I'm Hefsibah. In our group, we contemplated the difference between listening on the outside and listening on the inside. And how it was to be attentive to each other, listening to what each one was saying, but also noting how when it was going to be your turn to report, how your attention became much more acute. but it was really interesting watching that when you're listening on the outside, almost the body moves to odds and you know the attention is out there. But when it came to the turn to speak about oneself, to speak about listening oneself, it's almost like some kind of deepening process into the internal world. So you all have to sink, in a sense, to listen to yourself in order to put it out in the world.
Nice.
Go ahead. Okay, now it's on, right? what struck me was that I sat down with three strangers and people I didn't know their names, didn't know anything about them. And in a few short minutes, we went, and with a lot of silence in between, we went deep. And now Mark and Rob and Noel have become visible to me in a really sweet way, and each person reached deeply inside themselves to reveal something. It was very sweet.
Thank you. Nice to hear that.
Is it?
Yeah, there.
Can
yeah.
you hear me? My name is Silei. I just have one thought. I remember Gil mentioned just practice just, and I found it's delicious just listening, not doing anything else, not planning, not thinking, but just listening.
And when you listen that way, how well were you able to restate what you heard?
I feel there's an opening in my heart because I feel others is opening to me uh-huh. to share what their thoughts. Uh-huh. And I think it's an act of receiving, and I think someone else also mentioned it's a generous act to listen to others attentively.
Nice, beautiful. Thank you. Straight back to Judy.
We talked about how important it is. Everybody really wants to be heard and to be listened to, and we want to be listened to also. A couple of us talked about sometimes feeling like we don't want to listen to this person, and what do we do? And one option was to say, I'm having a hard time listening. Another option is to say, I'll stay with it, I'll listen, I'll try to understand.
Nice.
So I'd like to add something that other individuals have said, but maybe add a little bit more. For me, it was quite an incredible experience because I felt like the four of us, we cared for each other so nicely. The person before, like me, spoke very clearly and not on and on and on. And this person after me reflected what I had said. And there was this beautiful sense of, oh, we're caring for each other, and this kind of intimacy and sweetness of and how we were sharing and listening.
Nice. Thank you. What was it? Oh, yes, please.
I just have one quick thing. Along similar lines.
Your name?
Oh, Rob.
Mm-hmm.
I felt much less anxious to speak. And also much, I enjoyed listening a lot more, but I think it's because it's a topic that I'm interested in, and it's with people who are also interested in the same thing. In the outside world, I find it much harder to listen to things that I don't care about. and I try really hard to still pay attention, but I found it much easier in a setting like this.
Great. Yeah. So what was it like when it was your turn to speak about what you learned about listening? So you knew that people were listening, and the person next to you was really listening because they had to. What was it like to be listened to that way? Was that noticeable to you or different? Some of you talked about it, really listening well. But what was it like to be listened to in this exercise?
I don't think anybody's jumping at the mic so much, because for me, I was still concerned about what I was speaking. I was still more aware uh-huh. of speaking, not making it too long-winded, keeping it concise, so the person to the next would be able to not be too challenged, uh-huh. you know, in that way. So, but the environment was all is. Like Rob said, it was just so, the container was so receptive. There was such an awareness. And because we probably all recognize we're in the same boat, you know. Mm-hmm. So there was a definite community, a sense yeah. of community there that was developed very quickly.
Nice.
Feels to me like a great compliment to be listened to so intentively. Even if they don't care what I'm saying, they're listening to see if I'm going to say anything. So it did feel complimentary. I like it.
Nice.
Knowing that I'm going to be so carefully listened to, I did go deeper inside myself and tried to organize things and say things as concisely and clearly as possible. It was very, very definitely very mindful speaking.
Nice.
I don't like to speak. So I had to close my eyes and pull the words out of myself. It was when I speak, I'm there's some fear.
I really enjoyed listening. I didn't have trouble with that. I was aware that we were all so different, and it was really nice. I accepted that when I was listening. But when it came to me, the comparing mind came up when I started to talk. And I paused a little bit at that point, and because I was aware of it. And I just took a breath, and I thought, well, I go on. And I went on, and I didn't care any more about the comparing mind. So I was able to speak comfortably.
So recognizing and pausing. Recognizing it and pausing helped you to let go of it.
Yes.
Great.
My name is Mark. I've been in a lot of relationships and work dynamics where I've kind of desperately wanted to be heard. And then I found myself speaking with this small group, and my God, they were listening. And that took me aback and made me lose my thoughts a little bit.
My name is Jean. What I was going to say was that the first round, since there were three of us, we had more than one round. The first round was, I was more prepared and more, I'd thought about the subject matter. Just as you said not to. But the second round, I didn't have that opportunity, really. And it was a different kind of sharing. Mm. It was interesting. Maybe because it hadn't been rehearsed, it was different.
How was it different?
I don't want to say it was more real, because I don't think it was, but it was... since it was more spontaneous, it was a little bit of a surprise even for me.
Mm. Great, I love it. I mean, that's one of the great pleasures of speaking, is when we can surprise ourselves. And when you do these exercises, sometimes it takes a while to get to the point where we're at the edge of discovery rather than repeating back what we already thought about before.
And we did share that if it had gone around again, it would have been even more interesting for all of
you. So one of the very interesting ways of being in conversation with people is when you're going to speak in the conversation, to don't speak without first referring to something that they just finished saying. It can just be very brief. It can just be acknowledgement that you've heard them. I heard you say that, or it could be something. Even if you're going to take the conversation in a whole different direction, still take pause and acknowledge something they've said or refer to it, or even better, really clearly show how you're refer to something they've said, and that how you're building on that or adding to that. So there's a continuity of the conversation. It's very easy to be involved in our own concerns in such a way that someone says something and you're just kind of like happy they're finished talking. Like, they should have stopped sooner, because you have important things to say, and so rush ahead and say what you need to say. But it's actually very respectful. It just shows that you listen, and it shows that you're part of a conversation, and it shows that maybe you're kind of, in being part of the conversation, building on what's being said. It's evolving in some way, or something's happening. So I know it can be a little bit awkward in ordinary conversations, but you might consider situations and times where you can listen that way, and see if in listening in a way that where you're going to somehow connect to what they've said, build on what they've said, relate to what they're saying, as opposed to just only relate to what you have to say next. You might think it's building, but you know, they don't feel heard. What do you think of that?
You know, one of the interesting things I noticed, something was bubbling up that I was going to speak, and the speaker before me said something that seemed to be quite the opposite of what I was about to say. And so I stopped, and I was really looking at whether what I was going to say was still true in light of what she had said. So that was a good process to be going through, and I think that relates to what you're saying. You know, how is what you have to share changed by what the other person before you has just said?
Mm-hmm. So my reaction to that is, I think I do that most of the time. But I'm realizing that I have a tendency to distill what the other person is telling me in as a way of understanding what they're saying. Uh-huh. And I also tend to do it in communicating. And this exercise that we did made me realize that perhaps that is not necessary, and that it may be better to just listen and allow phenomenon to just arise and to be present for that. So, but it requires some trust.
So you're saying that you have a habit or a way, a practice of staying with someone, listening, but in order to distill what they're saying, and you do repeat back, say, kind of, this is what I've understood, just like I'm doing now with you.
Correct.
This, you know, but that perhaps there's something, some value to not trying so hard, because there's an extra layer, but. And so maybe just relaxing and listening deeply and then pausing and see what emerges.
Correct. And trust is and really trust. Important. Like, so there's some trust thing there of, like, just trusting that the response will come. It's mm-hmm. like the letting go into what is arising. Mm-hmm. I think my tendency to do this is actually a control thing.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah.
And so trusting that that there's a different processing going on in the conversation that's not the normal control place in you, and to trust that, and at the same time keep the principle in mind that you want to repeat something you've heard,
correct.
And but you don't know what that's going to be. It doesn't have to be a distilling of what they said. You know, it could be one word they said. You know, you said fear. You know, you're control. Oh, controlling. Oh, that's a big issue for me too. You know, as opposed to like the whole story, and that's great. Thank you, Catherine. Any other comments?
So I frequently hear interviewers on the radio do this. You've got a guest or a caller, and the MC, the interviewer, will say something the previous person just said before completely changing the subject or saying we've got to go to break or something, and it just feels so phony.
Phony?
Phony. like I know they're doing it because it's part of their job of how to be a good radio talk show host or whatever. Not talk show, I'm, you know, KQED, not whatever. Anyway, but I wonder if it's, if what I get about this is phony, like my emotional response is to feel ripped off. Like, you encouraged certain expectations in the listener and then threw them out the window. Did something completely different. So I'm wondering if what produces that feeling in me is lack of skill on the part of the interviewer, like he was using the right technique but didn't do it skillfully enough so that, you know, the technique showed, you know. Or is it that the interviewer who's doing this really lacks caring and really lacks heart?
I see.
For what he's doing, like, so is it just a technique and are they not very good at it, or is the person truly not engaged, and you can tell that in the way it comes off?
I see. So you're saying that that sometimes when someone has spoken, being interviewed, and it's time to end or have a break or something, and the interviewer does in fact refer back to what's been said, kind of bring it to conclusion or mark it in some way, so, but it sounds like a technique. It sounds doesn't sound,
yeah,
like,
or
really.
Maybe they're going on to another person. Maybe there's several people being interviewed on the show, or another caller. But before they completely change the subject, they'll, you know, repeat something that the previous person said, and it just feels very phony. So I'm hoping that as we try to be aware of this, that we don't come off that way to the people that we're conversing with.
Oh yes, that's the concern.
With.
That's great.
Because I've heard it done in a way that makes me feel
nauseous, yes. I appreciate that a lot, yeah.
Listen to Marcy carefully. I mean, along those same lines of parroting people back in the old Carl Rogers days, you know, just this empty restating. Oh, I don't feel well. Oh, you don't feel well. I think I have a cold. Gee, you think you have a cold? You know, makes you want to attack the person that's doing that. So that's what you're talking about. The same, if you want to call it a technique, can be used for good or for ill. It can be a reason to really only listen to somebody on a very superficial level.
Right.
And in our group, we talked about, don't you listen to people with your eyes? And don't you listen to the tone of voice in addition to the words and the posture? I mean, that there were so many ways that you could listen to somebody beyond just simply restating what they said.
Yesterday I was in a conversation where I restated something, or actually made an observation about what someone had just said. The person had talked for quite a while about something that was very important to her, and a conversation of three of us. And I thought it was important to kind of point to something that was going on, that to clarify the whole conversation. And rather than referring to what she had said, I said, you know, what I heard behind all the things she concerned, what she said was, you're afraid. And that immediately, she kind of relaxed. And immediately, oh, yes, that's what's at stake here. And then, so that was kind of a restating, but it was kind of, I was listening to something else. It's so easy to turn something into a technique that becomes a little bit artificial. The trick is to learn to internalize and make it kind of familiar and well understood, so we know when to use it, when not to use it. But in terms of Carl Rogers, I've seen these movies of Carl Rogers doing the work, and I think for the people watching the movies, we can't believe it. Like, you know, gee, this is like so phony. But it seems to be working. maybe it's very different to be on the receiving end than it is to be watching from the outside.
So I feel like along those lines that like we can always tell like what the character and the intention of the other person who is listening to us is. Like, so back to what we did in the group, I felt like their intention was right. So if they parroted a little bit, it was okay. But if they parroted just so that they could talk next, then it feels like I get hurt a little bit. So I think that that the character and the intention of the person really like makes the difference in that response.
Yeah, good. That's a good point. One more.
Some of the conversation just reminded me of some real-world challenges of listening. I have a couple of friends who are monologuists. And even, you know, it's like, hello, hello, and psh, they're off. And I don't know how to deal with that very skillfully, except to interrupt. It's just plain old interrupt the flow, and I get impatient and I tune out. One friend, I've even put the phone down and got up and done something. Swear. But anyway, that's just a real life challenge with someone who is not working in this kind of way.
Yes. Probably most of us know about this. Yes. So, so there are definitely challenges. So this world of speaking and listening has a lot of challenges, but that's why it's such a rich and important area to explore. And So one of the things earlier a number of you said was, I think, how sweet it was. I think you said also how quickly you formed a kind of a heartfelt connection with your group that you were there with, and people who are strangers. And so the idea of the sweetness and the intimacy and the closeness that developed in that short little conversation. And it was very sweet in the room. It was very nice, tender in the room, just being here, watching you, listening kind of to the background sound of people talking and all that. And so with that as a reference point, that feeling, that way of being, what is the ethics of speaking harshly? You shouldn't have said that. Boy, that was dumb. What do you think about this? So here we're talking about ethics, right? And that's one of the topics for this afternoon is the of ethics of speech. What wisdom do you have around this, the whole idea of, given what just happened, what was happening there, what light does that put on the choice of your words? And well, how you would track or understand harsh speech or...
Hello. Oh, there we go. I'm going to take a guess, but I mean, there are times in life when it is necessary to speak harshly, I think. And so those three guiding points about it being timely, kind, and for, I think the third one was for the other person's
beneficial.
Benefit.
Is it useful?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I mean, I don't think when your child runs into the street, you're going to say, you know, sweetie, please don't do that. You're going to scream at the child.
So this is a very good point that you're making, and it's a little different than what I was trying to get at. The reference point of the intimacy or the closeness of your group, you formed a community. You formed a little society of four or three during this time. And in that little society that you had, what's the ethics of speaking harshly in that context? So there's many, that's a great, many, it feels like a violation. What else? You speak loudly and I'll repeat.
Okay, what I think of is, in an intimate setting, what the intimacy is
I'm hurting. I'm speaking, I'm hurt, what's really going on is I'm hurting.
So if someone speaks harshly, it probably means they're hurt, they feel hurt. Mm-hmm. Or insecure or something else. Something interesting is going on in the background of that person, the fact that they would speak harshly in that kind of situation, because the situation doesn't maybe warrant it or something. Great. Good.
I have a reflection about the group talk. I feel like it makes me think about cause and effect.
Makes me think about cause and effect, and I think we should try. I mean, I want to try to create that type of situation with people that I care about, so to nurture that kind of listening and talking, because uh-huh. it's not always like I can't do that kind of listening all the time. And uh-huh. I think for me, if I create that kind of situation, like sitting down, being quiet, drop all my thoughts, then I'm likely. It's just not possible. It's really hard for me to become harsh, like talking harshly towards somebody.
Mm.
So I think it's probably a matter of also just creating that type of setting to talk and listen.
So rather than the idea of not being harsh being some kind of rule, you're interested in creating this inner feeling, inner situation, where you just simply wouldn't talk that way.
Yeah, I think it probably works better than I know, like, I should not talk like that. It will not work, like, I should not talk, but I just it's become my nature not to be able to talk like that.
Yeah.
It's easier.
I think it's really important what you're saying. And this idea comes to mind is the idea that if there's a rule, you know, I'm not supposed to talk that way. Boy, am I lousy. I'm a bad person because I'm not talking. I don't know how to talk. You know, I'm always talking harshly to those people. You know, harsh again, right? So just, but if you change your inner state, this is a very important principle in Buddhist practice, is we change our inner state, and with changing of inner state, our ethics flows from there, as opposed to rules. And it's a lot easier that way. Thank you.
So I think, in addition to not causing suffering in yourself and in others by creating the harm, I also feel like if I were to, you know, speak harshly in the setting that we were in, that I would actually be cast out of that group.
So
because the intention of the other groups is to, nobody likes it when you speak harshly. And so, like, in a way, I'm pushed away from the group by doing that.
Even though maybe it's not, you know, externally pushed away, maybe internally people like hold their distance or feel off. So in terms of creating social harmony or cooperation or connection, something gets severed there.
I've been playing with this idea of hard truths and resiliency in relationships.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what comes up for me when you mention this, is the relationship resilient enough for hard truths? And because I have a tendency to engage in harsh speech, this is up for me fairly regularly, and knowing where that boundary is. For example, I have relationships with some people where we can really hash it out, and we're very direct with each other, but it's not mean.
Uh-huh.
You know, so anyways, it just feels like that's an important question, at least for me, this resiliency of the relationship and the need to speak truthfully and sometimes hard truths, as I've heard them stated.
That's nice. Hard truths without being harsh truths.
Right.
It had been not be harsh. And also, this is a very interesting issue different people we have different kinds of conversations with. And sometimes having lively, strong, you know, conversation that maybe, you know, is part of what's understood. There's a trust or there's understanding. This is what happens in this conversation because similar personalities or similar trust or history with each other or something. But it's not necessarily suited for everyone.
What I was thinking about and debating whether I should say this or not, I have trouble with too much niceness.
Mm.
I mean, I find that when people are always so nice with you, when I first came here, that was a really difficult. Everybody, because I didn't believe it. I didn't believe people people could be that nice. Now, the opposite of that is not harshness, but you used a really good word. I like a stimulating, lively conversation with humor, and people are kind of maybe challenging each other intellectually, and it's in it because the other stuff it just feels like it's, you know, Johnny One Note. It feels restrained. It feels like I'm riding around in second gear to be like that. Yeah. You know, it's just not for me. It's sort of physiologically would be probably hard, but not for others. But
I agree. So I completely agree with you, and I think that this kind of environment here, this kind of teachings and all that, lends itself to people to err more on the side of being nice than sometimes being honest or whatever, right? And so to some degree, you have to put up with it. To give you a hard truth. And hopefully there's two more things. One is hopefully there's more benefit from how we are here than harm this way. But also I delight in people who show up who are differently, and that people come like you, who are a little bit more vocal and direct and opinionated, all the above, than most people who speak up in here. And I delight, it's very welcoming and it's reassuring that someone like you would come. The risk for you, though, is that you might become less that way the longer you stay. And then we'll have to...
I don't know, but if anybody would like to come home with
me... So a couple of more. Yes, here. Or is the other? Yeah.
I'm Noel. I have a situation where one of my children really prefers to talk with my husband. And I'll get answer the phone and I'm all excited, like, "Hi, Ben." And I want to, you know, hear about his life. I'm thinking I'm going to do some listening skills here. I'm going to, you know, it's not going to be all about me and whatnot. But he says, "Is Dad there?" And it's a harsh truth for me that he prefers his dad. And I don't feel like it's appropriate in my relationship with his son to tell him my feelings are hurt. I feel like that's the way it goes, and I feel like anything I say, he would absorb it as harsh. Even if I said, "I just am saying, I know, however I phrase it," it would knock him in a certain way. And I guess I'm just saying that there are so many conditions and nuances with relationships and right speech. And this is really tricky for me because I want him to thank him for the... I want to be thanked for the Valentine cookies, but he wants to talk to his dad. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just hard for me to keep a steady path with him.
Yeah.
That for us, right speech.
Maybe. So you know, you're pointing to is yes, that's really complex. Our relationship with all the different people in our lives can be complex, difficult. And so it takes a lot of care in understanding the situation, having street smarts, understanding all the different nuances, and understanding what can be done, what can't be done, how to do it, different things. And also considering, and one of the guidelines the Buddha gave for speaking is, among other things, we only speak when we know it's beneficial, when it's useful, when it has a purpose. So sometimes you simply can't communicate to some people, even though it seems reasonable to have this frank conversation with a son. If it can't be done, then maybe it makes it worse rather than better. It's better just to...
It's like right silence.
Yeah, maybe to be patient with it, or maybe to ask your husband if your husband could please say something to your son in some nice way, or just say, you know, just to let him know that it's so, how meaningful it is for you, if he could spend a little bit of time, or your husband can participate and with your concern, your husband hopefully can understand, and then your husband can kind of orchestrate sometimes that the two of, you know, he leave you alone a little bit. I'll come to the phone in 5 minutes. Just wait a minute. Just so he can help you. One more.
So I'm noticing that in terms of receiving harsh speech, it has been a really helpful litmus test for where I am with the hindrances or what's going on internally in the moment, because... you know, when it comes, can I receive it and have some equanimity with it, or do I notice aversion popping up, or do I notice myself wanting to push away from it? So it's actually, you know, some relationships provide these opportunities to just notice where the heart is still hindered in a way.
So what you're saying is practicing with the harsh speech coming your way and learning how not to, you get triggered by it, but somehow absorb it or be equanimous with it. Or
yeah, and you know, it's also a practice of, can one's own preferences be softened to the degree that, you know, you were kind of talking about softening your own preferences, right, but softened to the degree that I can listen to what's really going on for the other person, why the speech seems harsh, or where the vehemence is coming from.
Great. Thank you very much. So so as a way of concluding this before we go for lunch, is refer back again to the, you know, what for me was the sweetness of each of your little groups talking, and the closeness you felt and saw and how you were with each other, that to appreciate that in that kind of social environment, that certain ways of behaving have particular impacts. There was a way of talking that would have kept the group together, kept the intimacy, kept the closeness, and supported it. And there are ways that you could have been talking that would have disrupted it. Ways of bringing yourself together more, ways to actually make you fall apart. And that, so the ethics of speaking in Buddhism, it's not just don't lie, but it's also the ethics of don't divide. Don't be divisive in a negative way. And one of the ways of being divisive is to have cruel speech or harsh speech. It could be speech that's true, but speech which harms or hurts. And so in this kind of sitting, it's very clear the impact of it. That's part of the ethics. That's part of the, you know, the care that goes into this kind of talking. And so in Buddhist, I would suggest that this kind of intimacy you have is something that people don't have very often, very quickly in ordinary life. It's something that comes with a certain care and attention and environment that makes it happen. And so it means that that our ethics changes with the environment we're in, changes with the sensibilities, the state of mind, the care that individuals have. If we had all been kind of like, I don't know where, but at the racetracks, you know, yelling at each other, you know, it would have been fine to yell at someone again, because it just seems like that's what people do. I don't know if they do that at racetracks, but I don't know why.
Depends on
the bet. So anyway. So we'll take a lunch break for an hour. We'll start in here at 1:15. And so those of you who are new,